Well, it's May 11th, and this is Shirley Bradley and Larry Otis, and we're at the Orioles Museum, and we're just going to talk about real memories. And I usually start out by just getting a little background, a little personal history, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you happened to go to Rio.
Well, I grew up since I was 10 on in Lansing. And so I finished Oak Park, then the Patton Hill, then the Eastern. And then after graduating from Eastern, I worked at Treble Nosemobile briefly before I got drafted, got out. Been 2 years, and I had a series of jobs over the next 3 years. Then I went to a diesel mechanics training school in Chicago. And when I got out of that, I went to work at Rio in 1959. Mm. What did
they put you on?
Well, I was a truck mechanic on the repair floor.
Oh.
And similar to, Tom originally was on the repair floor, and then he went to quality control. And Dick Trio out there worked on the repair floor, and then he went on to, I think he went to college. He went back to college or something, and then he went on to tech service. And then I ended up working on diesel engines I was there about 10 years on repair floor, and I worked about 4 years on diesel engines. And then I ended up in engineering the last 2 years that Rio was in business.
Oh, you did.
And then it went into bankruptcy in 75, yeah. And that was the end of it.
Yeah.
That covers it, I guess, what you want.
So did you have any other relatives working there at Rio?
No. Mm-hmm. No.
So many folks did, you know, their mom
right,
or dad
yes.
or grandpa
yeah.
or grandpa. And so you started out in truck repair?
Yes.
You remember, and then you just mentioned some of the folks you worked with. Ray Kimble?
Yes, I met Ray. He's about the same age I am. He got out of Remus High same time I got out of Eastern in 51. And he came down here, of course, occupation-wise. And he was there when I went there. And then he went through a series of, I think he went from the repair floor to military engineering or something. And then he was with a separate unit, which... Francis Cappert bought it, he sold that unit off, and so Ray went elsewhere, right. I don't know, about 3-4 years before Rio went bankrupt.
I see.
But American General, and that in turn, it went out of business here, that division of it. But yes, I knew Ray and a host of other people that I've already mentioned, and then I got, I was on the credit union board for a little while. For about 5 years.
Rio had a credit union?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I think it started in 58. Of course, I think it went all the way till 75, and then it merged with, I can't think of the name of the credit union, mm-hmm. but it's another one here in town, which mm-hmm. also has absorbed a lot of smaller credit unions, and I don't know if it completely merged with another credit union or not, but... Yeah, that was there. At most of the companies that had 500 people or more had a credit union of some nature. And
was it in the building on the grounds?
It started in there. Yes, it was. The office was in there. I'm going to say maybe 11 or 12 years, and then about 1970, I think it went over on Home Street. Just south of Main, just across it. It's just off the intersection. Almost the building is right next to the railroad tracks.
Okay.
Where the now the eastbound exit from 496 curves around there.
Who are you talking about? Yeah.
Okay. Well, it was on the east side of Holmes, right next to the railroad tracks there.
Oh. Okay.
Right next to the expressway.
Right, to the expressway. During the years that you worked there, what would you say the working conditions were? I'm thinking of safety and...
It was probably about average for the industry at Lansing at that time. It was a very old building, and it often surprised me it didn't burn down.
Is that right?
Yeah, it had a lot of the building had, they were sawed-off blocks that were soaked in creosote or tar. A lot of the building was that way on the floor.
The floor.
Yeah, and when it had rain, it would seep in, and the blocks would expand and pop up. But it wasn't all cement like you'd think of the industrial setting nowadays.
And, is that pretty much true all over in the various buildings?
I would say maybe, I would think 60, 70% of it was that way.
Huh. And so the roof
but leak. And the roof leak. But a lot of the buildings, of course, came out of the, anywhere from, what, the buildings up on Washington Avenue, two or three of them, I think were like 1905 or 1909, and then it went on back to probably the 20s that some of the later buildings were built.
So the later ones were still pretty old, huh?
Yes.
Out of the 20s.
Quite a bit. To the best of my knowledge now, if you research some of this, the old John Dean plant used to be the body deal for real, the car bodies, and there used to be a tramway went over Cedar Street there for years, where the body was similar to Fisher Body Trucking to Oldsmobile. You remember that? Well, this is a similar deal. I think this was probably in the 20s. And then the old Duotherm plant down on Washington and Mount Hope, that was the Rio truck plant. But then, of course, in the Depression, everything, you know,
went down.
And so henceforth, the main plant became the total assembly plant for both cars and trucks. And then, of course, after the 36 model, there were no cars.
That's
after
right.
So, general summary of their, you know, their business.
It was a boom and bust business.
Oh yeah. Well, they weren't alone. The majority of industries.
As long as they got contract. Well, of course, during the Depression, everybody was.
Yes, hurting. Was hurting, right?
Yeah. Yep. And so, but you weren't there then.
No,
you were too young
I went
for that.
There in '59, and I was there until April of '75 when it completely. Well, they stopped all production and all the employees were laid off other than the people on the repair floor finishing the units that were built. And roughly from April till about September, I think, they had finished up a majority of the actual built units. And then, and I can't tell you the exact date, but then they had the bankruptcy referee or judge ordered liquidation, and then so they had an auction and bid on the remaining parts or equipment or whatever, and then they
after they closed the doors.
Yes, after they closed the doors, one of the vice presidents of parts, I think it was at that time, and the vice president in charge of production, they ended up as they were backed by another outfit out of Chicago, and they bought a majority of the parts, which became the nuts and bolts store, as they called it. And that succeeded there for a while, and then ended up in the John Bean building, I think. Mm-hmm. And a few of the employees worked for them for about a year and a half or so. Or 2 years.
To help finish up?
Well, they just sell, you know, equipment parts.
In the nuts and bolts store?
Okay. You may have heard this from some of the other people, too.
I knew about the nuts and bolts store being there, but I didn't know that it was in the factory for a while and then moved.
Briefly, yeah. I don't remember what the contract and circumstances are. Too bad you couldn't get Gary Hicks to interview, because he actually worked there for...
Well, I'm hoping to.
Yeah. He actually worked for the nuts and bolts end of it for a while.
Oh, okay. I'll remember that.
And so he'd give you more insight on that part.
Each of these cassettes kind of stands alone if somebody comes in to do research, you know,
right,
and wants to know a certain thing. So I just pretty much ask everybody basically the same questions.
Yeah.
What kind of pay scale do you remember that you had?
It wasn't bad as the general industrial pay scale. In fact, I talked to this fellow who's about 6-7 years younger than I was, and he retired as a skilled tradesman at Oldsmobile. And he had been a committee man over there, and I spoke to him in relation to general bargaining wage factor and conditions, you know. And we were usually, I would say, about one contract behind General Motors. And so pay-wise, we would be a little less than what GM was paying on a similar job titling.
Oh.
And but usually the next contract, we'd pick up about everything they negotiated. It was kind of a universal UAW type.
Oh, I see.
And I think in relation to John Bean and Duplex Truck and Tranter Manufacturing and some of the other industrial jobs close by, they paid less than Rio did. So Rio was probably just a bit under General Motors.
Kind of in the middle.
Yeah. And as far as health care, seemed to be very good, about as good as General Motors. Had a health care program with Blue Cross, Blue Shield. They had a... I can't remember the titling. It was similar to workman's comp. It would, if you were injured or if you were off on sick leave, they paid you, I don't remember, 60% of your wage for the...
Oh, 60%.
Something in that vicinity, you know, for the first few weeks. I never collected much, but it was there.
You never got hurt on the job? Or
well,
got sick, maybe?
Not to speak of, no. Oh. And in fact, I believe, thinking back, and this is a few years, I think I was off, I think I had a hernia surgery, and I think I was off one other time for almost a week. And, but that was the only time. I think I was off a week for a hernia, and I think I collected that week, but that was about it. Or maybe it was 2 weeks, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it had a reasonable, benefit package for industrial-type employment, I think.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
And you were able to go up in your job, what I'm saying, up to another level.
Pay scale-wise, you mean?
Mm-hmm. If they moved you from different jobs.
Yeah, it had a, I'm thinking it was like a, something like a 90-day deal, and then you became, I think 30 days you were supposed to join the UAW, you know, the union. It was sort of a closed shop, which wasn't all bad. 90 days you had pay scale raises. I don't remember specifically. I think after, I'm going to say a year and a half or 2 years, you hit maximum on whatever job titling you were at. And then I think it was the 1 week vacation the first year, and then after that it was 2 weeks to 5 years. Then it was 3 weeks between 5 and 10, and then it was 4 weeks.
You've been there quite a while.
Yeah, over 15, I think. Oh, I got into a different, they had, later on they unionized the office, and they called it the TOPS. It was Technical, Operational, and Professional. And when I went to engineering, I ended up in engine test and research in the basement of engineering. And for some reason, long before I went there, 4 or 5 years, that was in this TOPS deal. Well, then I went on salary, and rather than hourly. And also one of their, at that time, this would have been around 73 through 75, and they had a sick leave policy under that particular negotiated deal. Because I remember, if you weren't sick all year, you collected 10 days pay under that, but not... That wasn't true under the hourly out in the plant, so to speak.
And I
say this month. So it was a reasonable fringe package that way. An inducement to stay on the job, you know.
It sounds like it was a pretty good place to work.
It wasn't too bad, yeah. All in all, it as far as the general industrial setting, I think it was probably as good as I could expect. Looking back, of course, hindsight works well. And in a sense, in my case... it's good that it went bankrupt in 75, because it would, White Motor Company owned it, and they got into a cash flow problem, and then Francis Capert bought it. And, in 1970, he made a bid, which they accepted, and then between 1970 till 71, they rescinded and didn't want to sell it, and then he, filed a court action, and it looked like they would have to pay for a dead horse, so to speak, you know, if they kept it. So they ended up selling it to him. And it was about 71 through when they went bankrupt in 75, then, under that operation. And and of course, in 73, the economic conditions were terrible. They had the Arab oil thing, and the economy in 1973 went down. And it was tough on automobile industry, too, but also the heavy truck industry, too, was quite tough. And
so that didn't help.
No, it there were several other things. that became involved at that time. Money was, you know, the cash flow problem developed again for them as a smaller independent company, and then eventually they were forced to file bankruptcy and liquidate. So
Capert was a businessman out of Mississippi.
Yes.
It was more of an investment for him than a...
You sure you want to go there? If some of the other people burst...
No, we haven't gotten into it yet. Because basically I know, but people that are doing research might not know.
Well,
just whatever you're comfortable with.
Yeah. There were a lot of adverse things that happened along that period, yes, with his direction. I'll put it that way. It's the way I viewed it. And I understand he came from Clare originally. He came down to the St. Louis, Alma area, which made New Moon and Century trailers. Way back, house trailers. Learned the business there, went on down to Mississippi, opened a plant, did very well.
Oh.
And he ended up, I think, with five plants, sold them to Guardian Corporation, and then he followed a trend, I believe, of buying up older companies. And quite often, either selling off a portion of it or liquidating them, from what I understand. So, I guess that's about the biggest viewpoint I could tell you.
Okay, that's fine. The building was old.
Yes,
floors were old.
Quite old.
How about the machinery?
Yeah, a lot of it was. And then there again, reinvestment, because, say, for all purposes, White Motor Company went bankrupt in 1980. So if they hadn't got rid of Rio, they probably would have went under in 1982.
Oh, okay.
And although the name is still around, Volvo makes the Volvo white GMC truck out in a plant that was, I'm thinking Virginia. That was a relatively new plant that White had built.
Oh, it was.
And but actually the Volvo Corporation manufactures all three brands there since around 1980. They bought, I think, all the rights and some of the parts, but not the liabilities to White. So, and they carry, and of course, if you have a dealer network, it's beneficial to pick that up and continue producing units to keep the dealers and keep the sales organization, you know.
Sure.
So, the building was old, but two or three times it was proposed. White was thinking of building a new plant here, out north of town, but for one reason or another, it didn't materialize.
Would continue this, start all over again with a
For the newer plant, you'd get obviously get newer machinery and a better facility, but it didn't happen. So
you couldn't maybe attract enough money to help him get started.
Could be. I don't really remember exactly all the conditions, whether it was there was some question about the utilities being extended into DeWitt Township to service the facility, and I don't remember.
So there were a lot of problems.
Yeah, of that nature, you know, mm-hmm. Tax base would be there. Would it be annexed to the city of Lansing? Would it not? Would the Board of Water and Light have water and electricity facility to it? Things of that nature. But I really don't remember directly all the reasons why, but it didn't materialize.
Probably a lot of things, but that's interesting.
Yeah, it was proposed in paper and well thought of, and but it just didn't happen.
Oh. So those of you that were working there probably could see the end coming. Or not.
Well, yeah. I believe... I think it was something like $8 million that at that time that Capert borrowed from FMC, which had a division called John Bean across the street, and that was because of a cash flow problem. And there was some controversy on exactly how, when, and the methods that got paid back to FMC Food Machinery Corporation.
What does it stand for?
Food Machinery Corporation.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
It's FMC, and John Bean happened to be one of their divisions.
Oh, okay.
Across, you know, Cedar Street.
Mm-hmm.
And
so he was able to borrow
from
them for a while.
Right, for a while, a short period. And
going.
Anyway, then there was the the agreement with UAW, and if I remember right, it was in March, you had to pay, or the corporation was supposed to put something like a nickel or 6 cents per hour that each employee worked over the last calendar year. And they had from the first to the, till March, first of the year till March to, bookkeeping wise, amortize how many hours each person worked and put that much into the pension fund to fund it, so that if and when the person retired, that you know, there would be an annued retirement that they would get. And I think in 73 the cash was bad, and if I remember right, Mr. Cappert signed a note for 1.2 million, I think it was, with the Bank of Lansing at that time. I can't remember if it had changed names that time, and to the best of my knowledge, nothing was paid on that throughout the next calendar year. And then similar situation in 74. Uh-huh. And then it would have been prior to that, because they filed for bankruptcy in 1974 in December.
Oh,
and I think that was around March the second note would have been applied. And at that time, the Bank of Lansing, of course, became very nervous and went out to court in Mason and filed for a possession of assets that they had put into the pension fund, as they had received no payments. And the judge awarded it back to the Bank of Lansing. So.
All right. The pension fund went back?
Well, the
amount
those 2 years that they had put in, which amounted to, I think, about $2 million. But, everybody had over 10 years had a vested right and should be or has been receiving pension from it's the PBGC, Pension Board Guarantee Corporation, from the federal deal. This was just a relatively recent deal. Excuse me, the federal people had created over the 1973, because so many of these pension funds were going down. And I get my pittance every month of $81, which isn't too great, but
that's better than not.
Yeah, it's better than a sharp stick. And and most all the people I mentioned before are getting something.
Are getting something from their pension.
Depending, the different legislation changed it. I think Ray Kimball got about $7,000 or $8,000 back in, I can't tell you exactly, sometime either in the late 70s, early 80s. And at that time, it was a total payout commitment that you washed out on entirely. And you had the option at that time. And I didn't collect till I was, I think, over 60. I had the option to take about 66% of what I had coming at age 65. So I opted age 60, and I'm only getting about not quite $1,000 a year, but obviously I've got between $10,000 and $11,000, so I figured it was a better bet. There was no guarantee on tomorrow morning, so that's probably, and it allows me to buy lotto tickets and things. You know.
Well, looking back on Rio, I guess we're talking around it, but looking back on it, was it a good place to work?
I think it was fair, yes. I had reasonable memories, and in a general sense, probably I would say yes. In general, it was at the position in I was at on engine test and development emissions. Like I said, it looking back, it's probably good that it went bankrupt then, because at that time I had a reasonable deal and I liked it, and I would have stayed. And I think the company would have went under in another 5 years anyway. Mm. But due to the fact I'm a widower, but my late wife influenced me to take a civil service test. And I was a little questionable, but I did well and got in with the Department of Transportation as a heavy equipment mechanic. Oh. And so I got 23 years in there and retired. And
I was wondering, because I knew you'd be too young to retire when they...
I was 40, wasn't quite 43, and... Then fortunately, that went that way for me, which was a pretty good fringe package with the state.
Yeah,
and so I can't look back with, you know, too much sorrow that way. And I'm into my finishing my seventh year of retirement now, so things haven't been too bad.
Good.
Although my wife's been gone for 9 years.
Well, that's not good. No.
Well, but that happens, you know.
I know, that's the way life is.
Health reasons, yeah.
Do you, can you remember any humorous things that happened?
Oh, yes.
Or any things that were humorous?
Yes, there was numerous humor items, but I suppose the statute of limitations is long past on any of the fellow employees, you know. But, I remember, and I recall these to the people you've interviewed, too, but we had a way back, this is probably back in about 1960, I remember, when business was good, and when business was good, we worked overtime. One Saturday, I came in, and we were working 10 hours a day and 8 hours on Saturday, and a few of the people were inclined to cash the paycheck on Friday and get a little too much beverage, you know. And I remember at that time, this was previous to when Zen and Hansen came up with the Diamond T organization, and John Tucker was the president of it then. And we had one of the mechanics, and we were building pusher buses with a gasoline engine, which means the engine was in the rear of it.
A pusher bus?
Yeah. It's the same way like pusher motorhomes are with diesels now. They'll have the engine in the back.
Oh, that's what you mean.
Yeah.
Okay, it's pushing.
It's behind the rear axle, actually. Anyway, though, I remember this one person, he was still somewhat under the beverage that he had previously. He was out in the lot making laps around there on this. There was no sheet metal. It was just a frame and the controls and a seat, and the engine was at the back. And I remember John Tucker came out and stopped him, asked him where the other cars in the race were. And unfortunately, that same day, we had one of the body repairmen and painter. He came in, and he was too far into the beverage, too. And so he wanted to call his wife and let her know that he hadn't been home all night, that he was okay. He was just going to go back to work. And the superintendent saw him and said, "Well, why don't we just call a cab and have you go home and tell your wife?" He said, "I'm steady as a rock, steady as a rock." So henceforth, they called him Rocky after that.
Oh, that's funny.
But and a few other things of that nature. But there were different things for a period of time, you know. But those things come up continually,
and that makes it fun to work when,
well, as long as somebody don't get hurt. That was the dangerous part, you know. I used to worry about that some. And I know different times we had different military contracts where we they constantly road tested all the military units. And this one acquaintance of mine, it always seemed like when they had a breakdown, it was close to a bar, you know. And
isn't that odd how that works?
Yeah, it's all right. I'm in here warm. I'm just having a cup of coffee. But, you know, but anyway, we would go out and repair the truck and get it back, you know, and things of that nature. But, there were numerous smaller incidents like that. I remember different frivolous pranks and different things the guys would use, you know. But like you said, it's kind of in a jest. No, it wasn't anything that was really unhealthy or harmful, you know. But
just kind of fellowship.
Yeah.
What about the clubhouse? Did you have?
That was. I always had a lot of respect, a lot of regard for it. They had what they called long before I went there. They had what they called a charity ball, and this was a Christmas time party. Usually, it was about the first weekend in December, and I always enjoyed it. In fact, my wife always said it was nice to see all the people and dance, but usually I got too far into the celebration of the evening. But I went there most all the time. They had it at the clubhouse. They had a big big facility there. I don't know, you probably never saw it, but
I was 5 years old.
Yeah, oh, okay.
He took us down, and we saw Major Bowles, and you don't know who he is. But
yeah, I remember vaguely on radio.
He had it.
Yes, yes. In fact, he got caught up in this communistic thing later on.
Heard later.
Yeah, just towards the radio TV switchover period. that he got accused of being affiliated, but I don't know, you know. But yes, it had a big ballroom, had a mezzanine upstairs, and it had a pretty good organ up there, a pipe organ upstairs. And various facilities in the clubhouse. It was a nice building, of course. It was used by a lot of organizations. I remember even when I was getting out of high school, there were teenage dances there.
There were.
Yeah, they used to be downtown. The Pruden family had Pruden. They had the motor wheel company. They started that,
mm-hmm.
And it was Pruden Wheel Company. And like some of the other pioneers, Potters and Moores and whatever. Well, they had built that auditorium down there, which at the time I was getting out of high school wasn't very much, but they used to have teenage dances down there at the Pruden Auditorium. Well, then as that got decrepit and got demolished, then the Rio Clubhouse for a short time, they had teenage dances down there around the early 50s, I think. So it was a point of social, environmental contact, you know.
Sure, like the Civic Center of its day.
Right, and then after I got out of the service in the mid-50s, the Civic Center was under construction by 55. So, of course, that... And
a lot of people come in on tours and one thing and another. And several years ago, we had a Rio Day here. We invited everybody that, and I don't know whether you were part of that or not, but a lot of them talked about the clubhouse being torn down, and they said it was such sadness as if their childhood home had been taken away.
Yeah,
they were attached to the...
They had the bowling alley, and then, of course, the far be it for me to know the radio station was there, except reading about it.
Right.
But they had, it was a lot of social function for the people that worked there.
Mm-hmm.
And then even, do you remember the Red Stocking Dance? It was
a
charitable deal. Well,
I
okay.
Do.
They used to hold that on two nights there because of the capacity. And I don't remember what the capacity was, but at the time of it, it's primed through the 50s and through the mid-60s, and then it moved to the Civic Center, of course. And that drew quite a few people.
That was a charity for Christmas.
For the state employees would put that on. And that, That was state employees-oriented, but you could public could get tickets. I mean, it wasn't a closed deal. And this Rio Charity Ball was supposed to be for... families or whatever of people that worked at Rio that, you know, were illness, health, bad situations.
This was just for the Rio employees.
Yeah, where I think the Red Stocking deal was more of a overall community area type thing. But
I think so.
But yeah, they used to hold it on two nights in the late 40s down there. And henceforth, all of these things, you know, it would represent a social aspect of the Rio Clubhouse, you know, that people would remember memories and things there. So
when I talked with some of the gals in 92 that had worked in the office, sadly some of them are gone, but they would talk about the dances and putting food baskets together all of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think I'm out of questions. Unless there's something you'd like to add.
That reminds me, my wife was in private employment, and then she went to the... she worked for Liquor Control Commission for a while.
Oh.
And at that time, I'm talking in the 70s, where liability hadn't caught up with some of these things. And it used to be the vendors would come in, some of the liquor vendors, and they would put on a party at the Rio Clubhouse.
Oh.
They would have... this dispensing bar, it was all set up there. And, of course, naturally their own products. And I had gone there a couple times after my wife, had left private employment and gone to the state. She went about 3 years before I did. And then they would leave that up. The liquor and beer disappeared, but they had 7-Up and Coca-Cola and other things, you know. And they would have a kids' Christmas party at the clubhouse and that next morning, afterward.
Sure.
And it was,
I look back on the clubhouse as a very social center aspect, you know, where a lot of times...
There aren't too many places that have that sort of thing.
No, there isn't. And, well, at that time, the capacity, and I can't tell you number-wise, but there wasn't...
200 or 300 before, or something?
Oh, I would think it would even be upwards to 800, I would think.
Oh.
But it was about, that was about the limit, see, and of course, the Civic Center, I don't know, it accommodated, what, about 6,000 to 8,000, I think, something like that, I don't know. But at that time, there was no other banquet or facility to much over 100 people, you know, and so naturally, it was a focal point there, and so forth, but...
The athletic teams and that sort of thing weren't there by the time?
To a degree. Yeah, I knew several people, and the Diamond Rio ball team, softball team, was very competitive. They had some very good players on that in the as late as even the early 70s. And Howdy Hillard, Doug Sleep, Jerry Mitchell, they were well respected in the City League, and then there were several people who weren't Rio employees who also played on that team, but I think they got Diamond Rio to sponsor it, you know. And but, in fact, has anybody mentioned the pistol team?
The what?
Pistol team.
No.
Well, I had heard of it, and I saw a couple pictures. Well, then up on third floor, just over from engineering, they had this pistol range.
Oh, they did?
Yes, and... there was two or three guys I knew of. It wasn't real common. And they'd go up and practice at a cement wall, you know, and then they had these targets hanging there. And I guess they had a competition league with a couple other, organized pistol teams.
And they would compete.
Yeah. And that was the real pistol league.
I never heard of that.
Yeah, it was upstairs on third floor. It wasn't. I don't recall that it was well known in there, but I knew of it. And a couple of times I went up and glanced at the facility up there. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of a different offshoot to...
Absolutely.
To put a play on words.
Yes.
I'm guilty of that continually. But
afraid I am too.
Yes. Well. So there were, in a sense, it might be a paternal employee factor, you know, to that. But... and they had, and I think in the mid '60s they had a somewhat of a RV or outdoor club too. Some of them that you know they the pickup truck campers came on real big towards the mid or late '60s, and I remember they had, I would dare say, a dozen or 15 people that had them there, you know, they would plan a few events, I remember, together. But there are probably numerous other deals, too, but I can't immediately think of them.
Well, that would give anybody listening, you know, a feel for not only the work side, but the social side.
That's right. A little bit of a fraternal feeling among the people a group feel. Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah. Well, can you think of anything else that you'd like to add? Something I haven't brought up? If not...
No, I asked Tom and I asked Ray. Well, you hadn't done Tom. You did him earlier today. But I asked Ray and I asked Tom, and they said, well, they were just on the impression that, that you would ask a few questions and then they could bring up things that they'd thought.
And that's pretty much the way it's gone, and that's been great.
Yeah.
I thought the questions would just be to get things rolling and bring out some points and give people something to talk about.
There again, I don't know what the initial deal of the Army truck deal, but they had a good inroads on that. And this was one of their better avenues of manufacturing and income of the company, you know, over the years. Because they seem to be quite well respected in that, and during the end of World War II, the Korean War, and even on continuing from into the '60s, we had numerous military contracts for trucks, and they seem to be pretty good. The government seemed to like them all right.
And I imagine if the company was still producing trucks, right, and gone out of business, they would be doing military contracts through Vietnam and
probably
and wherever
imagine,
else.
Yeah. But in fact, I know when I was in the military, the GMC and then the Rio were about the two and a half ton trucks were about that. That was the only two there were basically in the Army.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I don't know too much else of. Did you go back and pick up Heaney Hearst and Body Company and Bond Aluminum? And well, they came along in the 50s at economic tides, you know. They had this, I think it was Henny or Heaney in Ohio that built, and I think they're still in business maybe. They build ambulance bodies and so forth. And you could look this up in some of the books. And I don't know, they bought enough stock to control the company. I think that was it. And then they sold it to Bond Aluminum.
That one I've heard.
And at that time, they had quite a facility, I think, in the St. Joe Benton Harbor area, Bond Aluminum did it. Mm. And then they, I think it's BOHN, I believe.
I think it is.
And there again, I'm guessing maybe 55, something in that neighborhood. I don't know. Maybe a little. But anyway, they held it for a while and decided, you know, it wasn't a good diversification, and they in turn sold it to White in 1957.
Now, these two companies, were they making engines?
No.
Or they were making materials?
Yeah, they were separate from the truck business entirely. Heaney Body Company, they made ambulances and hearses down in Ohio, I think. I believe. And Bond Aluminum was in the aluminum business down in, I think, St. Joe Benton Harbor area at that time. Reputedly, if I remember right, and I'm straining my memory, was they were going to use Rio trucks for semi-tractors to haul their product to various spots. Now, you know, whatever happened, I don't think they held it too long because they sold it to White Motor Company in 57. Mm-hmm. And then White Motor Company bought Diamond T Truck Company down in Chicago in 58. And then brought the whole Diamond T operation up here, I think in 1960, and then they built both brand trucks till 1967, and it all became Diamond T then, and well, it was Diamond Rio is what it was, and they merged them together so it was only one
Diamond
truck.
T, yeah.
Yeah, it was the Rio and the Diamond T. But we built, I remember there were both models, you know, you could get them with a little different trim on them, you know, and it was a Diamond T or it was a Rio. And then they finally, in 67, merged it as Diamond Rio.
Now, that Gold Comet engine and the Comet
That was
engine.
A very good product. And I can't tell you specifically what year they introduced it, but I had occasion to do some test and whatever development and engineering. And it was a good, durable truck engine. So, of course, wouldn't a wet sleeve engine would mean anything to you, but you know, it had its own uniqueness, and it was a good, heavy duty gas engine, very good quality. And that was one of their premium, the Gold Comet trade name, and well respected. You know, it was a good producing engine in the heavy-duty truck business.
That was the engine that they were still producing, right?
Yes.
Close to the end?
Oh, yeah, right up to the end.
To
in fact,
the end.
They were still
okay.
Using it. But Diamond T had a heavier truck-style model, more over-the-road freight hauling, and when they came into Rio, they introduced a lot more bigger diesel-powered units. And it wasn't very long before, of course, Diamond Rio had its comparable models, you know, of semi-tractors with heavier hauling capacity with large diesel engines. But yes, the Gold Comet was still going when it went bankrupt, yes.
Now, what was the Cummings engine that I heard
that's
about?
That's a separate, that's a in Columbus, Indiana. Still going, still terrific. Hmm. Big producer of diesel engines and... They
Were they ever put into the real truck?
Oh, yes. Oh. They're a good, they were a thorough product that was well known and well respected.
So that was like outsourcing.
Yeah. They were, they'd buy, well, that's what I did for about 4 years. At that time, they had Detroit Diesel, and Cummings were the two prevalent engines that were diesel engines that were put into the Diamond Reel product. They would order a, because there was delivery lead time on them. In other words, if you want 50 engines, you put in the order, and it might not, you know, it might be a little bit of month or so before you got them. So they ordered spec engines, or what they called them, a basic engine. And then they sent this other fellow and I to school down at Detroit Diesel and down at Columbus, Indiana, to Cummings Engine Company. And we went through school so that we were authorized to do certain things to change the engine to fit the model.
Oh.
And that way the engine company felt comfortable. Yeah, these guys are trained, they can do it, so we don't start losing engines out here on warranty. And towards the end of the 60s, it was a very good heavy duty truck market with the Diamond Reel truck. And in fact, we even did a few mid-range engines. And Detroit Diesel was part of GM, but there again, the management of GM didn't do as good a job with the Detroit Diesel division, and it went down, you know. And then Roger Penske, I don't know if you've heard of Roger Penske, but he bought off about 80% of Detroit Diesel.
Oh.
And he now owns, his organization owns about, and for all fact, he brought back a good product. They've changed dramatically in the last 15 years. But in the same way with the Allison transmission is well respected. It's an automatic and heavy-duty truck transmission. And that used to be a division that was Detroit Diesel Allison. And there again, I don't think GM did enough of research and development, but that's a separate division down in Indiana now that somebody else bought. And everything changes.
It, oh, yes.
You'd think that GM is the ultimate decision maker, but it's not true. They've made a few circumstances that error decisions, you know, but that's life.
Yeah, it is. Well, I thank you very much for coming in.
Oh, fine. Good.
And,